like potato, and I like patata. You like tomato, and I like tomato. Potato, patata, tomato, tomato. Oh, let's call the whole thing off.
Oh, let's not. No matter what you call it, almost everyone loves the tomato. For more than 45 years, the city of Reynoldsburg has organized the Tomato Festival in celebration and remembrance of a proclamation naming the city as the birthplace of the commercial tomato. Coming up later this hour, we'll get some growing tips from Central Ohio's garden sage, Deborah Knapke, and then we'll hear what has happened to the modern grocery store tomato over time and learn about the scandals around how it's grown and harvested. First, let's talk about the festival. For more detailed information about the festival, go to ReynoldsburgTomatoFestival.org. We'll post that link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And right now we welcome Mary Hudson. She is the president of the board that organizes the annual Tomato Festival here. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you so much for having me.
I should say there, Reynoldsburg, outside of Columbus. You're also executive director of the Reynoldsburg Visitors Bureau. So what sort of crowd do you attract to the festival? How much commerce does it bring to your city? What does it mean to the city?
Well, obviously, it's our signature event. And it's in the last few years has kind of taken on a different look. It, like I say, it's been going on for 46 years. It started in 1965. And 3 years ago, the group that had originally done it disbanded and a new group took over, and that's when the Visitors Bureau got involved with it and moved it to a different location in the center of the city, which has just worked out wonderfully. We no longer charge for parking. It's a free festival, and people from all over the community, it's very accessible. And as far as the nice thing is, it is right in our downtown area. So a lot of the businesses, they're seeing people, you know, driving through town, coming into town, that wouldn't necessarily stop in some of our shops along Main Street. So obviously there's a great economic impact for us with the festival being in town.
How many people does it attract?
We changed it 3 years ago to just a two-day event. It's okay. Friday and Saturday. And we anticipated last year 8,000 people and pretty much hit that. We can tell by the amount of tomato juice that we distribute. That's our benchmark since we're not charging for parking.
And how much tomato juice did you distribute? How many gallons?
Gallons and gallons and gallons. Uh-huh. We actually, last year, one of our new local grocery stores sponsored, and we had to pour instead of having the small, you know, little cans. Uh-huh. And it was just, it took forever. And I mean, you know what? We should probably check and find out, you know, how many gallons are we dispensing? But this year we're looking between 8,000 and 10,000 people in the 2 days.
There's been a lot more. Well, first of all, let's talk about why Reynoldsburg. Why Reynoldsburg and a tomato festival? Where does that come from?
Okay, but in 1965, the local firefighters decided that we needed a festival. And they start thinking, well, a lot of people have a purpose. So we're the birthplace of the tomato. And that was because of Alexander.
Of the commercial tomato.
Of the commercial tomato. And that was because of Alexander Livingston, whose home is in Reynoldsburg. As a matter of fact, the Visitors Bureau is housed there. It's an 1860 farmhouse on 6 acres. It's a city park. It's a beautiful, beautiful property. And that he was a horticulturist, and he was the one that developed the first smooth skin, the Paragon, which was one of his signature tomatoes. And prior to that, a lot of people thought it was hairy. So he not only developed the Paragon tomato, but then he also was the first in this area, for sure, to put it into commercialization.
And when we say commercialization, that means where you can mass produce it.
Mass produce or use the tomato for sauce, juice, that type of thing is what he got involved with.
Does Ohio have necessarily a big? I think it's third in the nation, mm-hmm, in tomato production, but that's mostly for commercial, for processing.
Yes, I would think so.
In mm-hmm, Ohio, so how has there's been a lot of increasing interest, probably in the last, you know, 10, maybe even more realistically, 5 years, really, in things like heirloom potato tomatoes, growing tomatoes in your, mm-hmm, garden, that kind of a thing. Is that reflected in your programming?
We have tomatoes on site. We have a fantastic farmer's market that we just started a few years ago. So we work with the state ag labs, actually, are in Reynoldsburg. So we work closely with them, and we have a nice selection of fruits and vegetables for people to purchase. But other than that, it's just kind of the fun things. We have fried green tomatoes, which are incredibly popular. Anything that's made with tomato products. We had Just Pies, which is a great pie company here in the Columbus area. Mm-hmm. And they created a tomato pie for us that we will have at the festival. And I think we've got tomato Buckeyes, tomato fudge, all kinds of things like that. But it's basically more fun. Like I said, the you know, to bring in the agriculture portion of it, we do have fresh tomatoes and that type of thing on sale and on the grounds.
Now, in Circleville, in the pumpkin show, right, they have the competition for the biggest pumpkin. And I was wondering if there is any if there's any sort of competition comparable to that at the Reynoldsburg Tomato Festival.
Yes. We have the same type of thing. We have the tallest tomato where people grow their vines and we go out. And all, as a matter of fact, people from all over Franklin County have entered.
How many entries do you have for something like that?
I think we probably maybe get 7 or 8 for the tallest tomato. Uh-huh. I know one as far away as Hilliard that said, you know, I've got a tall tomato, so we have to go out. We have the tiniest tomato, the ugliest tomato, you know, the grouping. And then we also have, along with that tomato contest, we also have included gems and jellies and salsa.
And they compete.
And
there's a taste testing thing.
Yes, and they compete. There's judges. As a matter of fact, one of our judges is the head of the agriculture labs. So it's great. And the interesting thing is that the kids, you don't think about, you know, that the children want to know their heritage also. And so many of the younger ones, and we have them in cases that are closed off, and they're just peeking in there, looking at all the different, you know, realizing that there's a lot of different strains of tomato. So that's our one competition. And the other one is our pizza taste off.
Tell us about that.
That's just where we get as many local pizza places as we can. And they come in, set out their pizza. We sell tickets. People come in, get a drink, and get to test all the pizza, and then they get to vote. So it's the who won the Tomato Festival Pizza Contest. So it's enough, kind of helps drive business to whoever our winner is.
My guest is Mary Hudson. She is the director of the Reynoldsburg Visitors Bureau. She's also president of the board that organizes the annual Reynoldsburg Tomato Festival. She's going to be with us until about 20 after. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Have you ever entered a tomato contest? The ugliest, which often are the best tasting tomatoes, I might add. The tallest, mine have all fallen to the ground and are like ground vines now. Still producing, however. You have a question or comment for Mary, want to talk about your tomatoes, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, do people actually talk about tomatoes at the Tomato Festival, Mary?
I believe a lot of the, when we moved the location, a lot of the people that have lived in Reynoldsburg 40, 50 years and could have been, you know, very instrumental in starting the festival, started to come back because it's in a, you know, close hometown. It's more of a family-friendly environment. And, boy, they're all there, and they're talking about their tomatoes and what they've grown and how long, you know, they've been doing it. So I think there is in the old. And the nice thing is we've kind of tied it in. Our farmer's market ends on Thursday night, and the festival starts on Friday. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have, you know, been through, and they see the festival being set up. So we get a lot of people coming back that really were, you know, were coming for the farmer's market.
Last night I was with some friends and I told them I was going to be doing this show today, and we started talking about tomatoes for the next 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody had a tomato issue, which we'll talk about with Deborah Kanapke coming up. Lots of questions for Deb. So if you have a question or comment about your tomatoes, have any problems with them, you can give us a call and talk to Deborah in the next segment. Right now, it's Mary Hudson of the Reynoldsburg Tomato Festival. Mark, you're on the air from Lincoln Village. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi. I have a secret weapon that I use every year. I go out to Darby Creek and catch me some bluegills and bury them underneath them. And that's what the Indians used to do, too, with their corn and maize and their beans, the Three Sisters.
What is that? Why is that? What is it? What's the magic?
It's like a fertilizer or something.
And you go to Darby Creek. Is there something special about the Darby Creek, or would any old bluegill? Okay.
I took it by the house.
And what kind of tomatoes do you grow?
I get them from Hoffman Farms. I try to grow all different kinds because one year, you know, then another secret is don't plant them in the same spot year after year. That gives that black mold on the bottom.
Okay. And so you plant lots of different kinds so you can move them around.
Well, you can't plant tomatoes in the same plot year after year, or you get that black mold.
Okay. So what do you do? How big is your yard?
My tomato garden this year is where I had a swimming pool set up last year, and it killed all the grass. So I went ahead and tilled it up.
Okay, you just gave me an idea. We're taking down our tramp this in a few weeks. I'll make that my tomato garden next year. Mark, thanks for your call. Thanks for listening.
All right, God bless.
Thank you. Mary, before we take off, I wanted you to tell us what else is going on at the Tomato Festival besides tomatoes.
Okay, it's a great festival. We want to thank our presenting sponsor, which is Heartland Bank. And when you talk about commerce, it's nice to have the local sponsorships that we have because we could not put on the festival without them. This year, some of the new things, we've got Ashley Everts and the Country Thunder on Friday night. Our headliner on Saturday night is McGuffey Lane, so we're looking forward to that. We have a wonderful cruise in that has grown. That's also on Saturday night. We went away from carnival games and basically have games that were made for children, and we have half a dozen inflatables, which have become very popular even with the teenagers. This year I've got a climbing wall, and we also have the world's largest pinball machine. So there's some different things this year that we haven't had before. We have a pool party for the teenagers on Friday night. And then on Saturday night, at dusk, after our main entertainment starts, we show the movie Attack of the Killer Tomato. So we carry our theme clear through to the end. So a lot of families bring their blankets and go back. We've got one of the giant outdoor screens and show the Attack of the Killer Tomato. So that's a lot of fun. But a lot going on all day. It starts out Saturday morning with the Mount Carmel Fitness Challenge. That was a standalone event for many years on Labor Day, and the city asked us to move it and make it part of the Tomato Festival event. So the Mount Carmel Fitness Challenge starts out at City Hall on Saturday morning, and that is a 10K and a 5K race.
Looks like you have some good weather coming up, too.
It sounds like it. We're very excited.
Never know, though. They said it was going to rain today, and it's clear. It's clear as a bell out
yes
there.
Yes or no?
Hey, Vaughn in Forest Park? You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I wanted to share with a larger audience a tomato plant that I had once, which we bought just at a fundraiser, Lions Club or some kind of fundraiser.
Mm-hmm.
But it grew to over 10 feet tall. I didn't think much about it during the season, but on November 3rd, with snow on the ground, I picked 173 tomatoes off of this one plant.
Wow.
Having to use ladders to climb up.
How big were the tomatoes?
Well, they varied. You mean the 173?
Yeah.
Well, they varied from normal size to very small ones. But they're, you know, it froze, so I cleaned the tomato plants of all of them, put them in paper bags, and most of them ripened. But this was the last day, so it grew all season. And we harvested during the season. I would not share this unless I had witnesses.
Okay.
We were so busy that
because
summer,
we were going to say, and how not big it was, this big,
yeah,
right?
No, they can witness that you having to use ladders to harvest the
did
tomatoes.
You take pictures?
I don't know if we have pictures. I did. I'm very good at growing things. And
okay.
I'm so busy building a house that I didn't really think much about it.
You are good.
I use compost, natural fertilizers, and so on. So I'm used to getting large yields, but I have never heard it of anything like that. Now, I've seen ads in papers in recent years of what they call a tomato tree. You buy this plant and it'd be a tomato tree.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be a freak of nature, but I wanted a larger audience. I tell my Bible study and other groups that I always share it with people, but it is just, and I grew up on a farm where we commercially raised tomatoes, 150 acres of tomatoes. So I knew something about tomatoes, but it didn't occur to me to contact someone at Reynoldsburg or at the Ag Department to come and measure it or do something because it was a freak. But 173 tomatoes.
Wow. On the last day.
On the last day.
Wow, that's something.
I had no idea what I'd picked off. We picked off during the season. It had to be bushels. I mean, we used to think 10 tons to an acre
wow
was a big yield, but this.
If you had an acre of those, it'd be off the Richter scale.
Be
well, Vaughn, thank you.
World. Okay.
Thanks for sharing that story. We
thank
believe you.
For you.
Okay.
Opportunity. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Mary Hudson, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
And thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, and we hope everyone will enjoy this beautiful weather and come out to the Tomato Festival and Saturday.
Mary Hudson, she's the president of the board that organizes the annual Reynoldsburg Tomato Festival. If you want to know more information about it, we have a link for you on our website at WOSU.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Boeing decided to move manufacturing to low-cost South Carolina. Washington said no. Now there is a giant fight. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins later today at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 76 degrees with sunny skies. Partly sunny skies throughout the day. Today, a high of 87. Clouds move in tonight, bringing a chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm, a low of 66. More sunshine for Friday and a high of 87.
Support for 89.7 comes from Antioch University Midwest, helping adults to complete their bachelor's or to start their master's degree. Last call for fall classes begins soon. More information at midwest.antioch.edu.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
You've been picking my tomatoes, tapping on my mind. Been picking my tomatoes, tramping on my line. I've got a special plan.
Okay, have you been picking tomatoes in recent weeks is the question today. Or not. Joining us now to talk about the art of growing tomatoes in your very own backyard is Central Ohio, or in your front yard for some people, is Central Ohio's garden sage and regular All Sides guest, Deborah Kanapke. Deborah is a garden designer and consultant. She's the author or co-author of several gardening books. We talked about them many times, and she teaches horticulture at Columbus State Community College as
right.
well. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
So we got into a little bit of the issues of tomatoes mm-hmm. this year, and you know, and one of our callers had some really great advice that you've given us before: is don't plant the tomatoes in the same place.
Absolutely, rotate, rotate, rotate.
Why is that though?
Well, and I have some pictures of some ugly stuff here on the table. Is that the soil? Pathogens build up in the soil, and no matter how hard you try to clean up, which every year I religiously clean up all my tomato debris that I see out of my garden and put it in what I call my bad compost pile that I never go into, and it just sits there and, you know, it's done for all intents and purposes. But these pathogens build up: early blight, late blight, septoria leaf blotch or blight, or I mean, they all have blight, you know. This is not a pleasant thing. And you know, it's just amazing what builds up in the soil. So you need to move your tomatoes somewhere else, plant something that is not in the same family, the Solanaceae or nightshade family, as it is called. Plant something that's not in that family, kind of let that soil clear out. We, in our own garden, we move our tomatoes, we'll leave them in the same place 2 years maximum. And we have five different places we can put it in the garden. So Tony, bless his heart, takes apart the whole trellis system we have and then puts it in another part of the garden. And so we keep track of where it is. So it's 10 years before the tomatoes get back in the same place they were. And by that time, those pathogens have gone down to a dull roar in the soil. And, you know, and they can build up again. Now, something else that I do, and I'm going to try this year, I'm going to get some hot chicken compost, you know, new stuff. And once the tomatoes are out, I'm putting it in there and turning it into the soil, into the place that we're going to put the tomatoes for next year. And it's high in nitrogen, and it also will burn the dickens, I hope, out of the pathogens that are in the soil.
And maybe help move that,
help, you
speed
know,
that up.
Speed that up. And also, for those of you who know Dr. Harry Hoytink, who's professor emeritus at Ohio State University, he did this big study about compost suppression of pathogens in potting soil, and it works using hot compost, or even just plain compost to make the plant stronger so they can resist the pathogens in the soil. So again, it comes back to feeding your plants correctly, not giving them too much, but giving them what they need, and they can, so they can resist the pathogens that come to attack them. And that's just the diseases. Then there's the insects. You know, I mean, there's
and then
a lot
there's
of
the
reasons.
Wild animals.
And then there, that's why we have a 7.5-foot fence around our garden.
Someone, there was an article out there about squirrels.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with squirrels and tomatoes. Any suggestions on that score?
You know, I've not had so much problem with the squirrels as chipmunks and raccoons, which are, for the most part, the raccoons are kept out by the fence, but the darn little chipmunks just climb right up and go over. What they do is they sink their teeth into them. You get these little teeth marks. They don't really eat much. Now, maybe that's squirrels, and I just didn't know it, but
you know, those little marks, I just cut them out.
Yeah, well, so do I.
Yeah.
You know, unless it's not looking good, you know, getting kind of puffy and moldy, then I might reconsider. But no, we don't waste our tomatoes. We make sauces. We roast them. We do all kinds of things with our tomatoes. In fact, today we'll be making our most favorite eggplant tomato casserole, which, you know, I'd be happy to. How can we put that up on Facebook or something?
Oh, yeah, we can post that on Facebook. Easy. Also, I have the Dan Fisher Facebook page.
Okay, so, but if I send it to you via email, you can put it in a format so it goes, okay, I'll send the eggplant tomato recipe.
We'll post that. Heck yeah. And if you have any questions or comments, you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. You can tweet us, Ann Fisher, WOSU. You can call us, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Whatever fits the bill for you. We have an email from Tom in Waverly.
Okay.
He said, I know today's program isn't a cooking segment. Tom, we can turn any segment into a cooking segment in my book, but I wanted to share how my mother uses tomatoes. She makes fried half-ripe tomatoes, which we find are far better than the fried green ones. She takes half-ripe tomatoes, slices them, douses the slices in flour, and fries them in bacon grease, adding salt and pepper in the skillet. She browns them on both sides, turning only once. I made them one evening this week, and not having bacon grease, I used olive oil. They were delicious. We called them fried pink tomatoes.
Okay.
That's great, Tom. Thank you for that suggestion. If you have any suggestions, you know, quick suggestions about how to use your tomatoes, because, you know, it's that time of year where all of a sudden there's a proliferation of them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And if you have any questions for Deborah Kanapke, our guest right now, give us a call. And Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Cincinnati, great.
I was wondering about acid soils. I have an area that was planted in yew bushes for about 50 years, and the yew bushes are gone. I've been using the soil for a garden and trying to grow tomatoes. And the tomatoes I had last year, they looked fine. They bloomed fine. I thought I was going to have loads of tomatoes. Nothing happened. All the blooms left, and there was very few tomatoes. The tomatoes that were there were okay. But I was just wondering if a super acid situation like what would be left over from yew trees or yew bushes for about 50 years would make a difference.
Have you tested the soil? And the reason
I'm sure that the bushes have contributed some acid to it.
I'm sure they have, but in Cincinnati, just like in Columbus, we have more alkaline soils, and I think you need to test the soil to make sure that you have as low a pH as you think you have. I'm imagining after a couple years that the soil is going to buffer back to its native pH. So you want to take a look at that. As to blossom drop and tomato drop, that is due to many, many issues. Not enough water, too much water. You won't even get blossoms if the temperatures are above, I think it's 86 or 89 degrees.
Noticed it this year.
Yeah, the blossoms, the blooming stops. There's a stall. And I think it is 86 degrees. So it might not have been due to your soil, or there might have been a combination of a soil pH issue, low nutrition, and then the heat. Because last year we were hot. We were hot this year,
but
too.
But the heat came later last year.
It did.
This year it came when the plants should have been blossoming, is
right.
What I noticed. And I was, and sure enough, as soon as it cooled off a little bit, it started to blossom up a lot, yeah.
And the big difference, too, is our night-day temperatures. There needs to be a differential. When our temperatures are real close together, day and night, no blossoms. And then you get fruit drop and fruit rot and so many things. So, Tom, I think you need to do a soil test. And then you can amend with, I would ask the soil lab.
How do you do a soil test, Deb? You've mentioned that before. What's the deal with the soil test? And Don in Cincinnati, thank you for your call. We appreciate
it. Good luck. Soil test, well, in Columbus, we have CLC Labs in Westerville where you get a little, you can call them up. They're on the web, too. They are in conjunction with Purdue. But you can call them up, get a little bag with instructions on how to take soil from your yard. You put the soil in the bag, you send the bag to them, and they send you a soil survey back. And depending on how much money you spend, you can get different tests done. pH, NPK, organic matter, whatever. So it's sort of like a recipe. You choose what information you want to know from that soil sample, and you send your check with your soil, and you get back an analysis. And then there are often recommendations on how to make the soil, like say they ask you what you want this area for, a vegetable garden, ornamental, etc. Most of our vegetables do well from the pH of about, 6.5 is perfect. And we tend to be a little bit higher than that. But still, we do grow good vegetables. My soils in my yard are between 6.5 and 7.2. I have a range. Depends on where it is in the yard. So testing your soil is a really good thing to then figure out what to do next. Like with Tom, if he does indeed have acid soil, he'll need to add some calcium carbonate, gypsum, whatever, which will bring that soil pH up a little bit. But I'm not sure he'll have to do that.
Mark in Pickerington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark.
Hello, Mark.
Can you hear me?
Yep. You can.
Okay. I have a couple of tomato plants that I grow in the upside-down tomato hangers hanging off my deck.
Yep.
And this year I got attacked by what I looked up to be tobacco hornworms.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yuck. They sound gross.
They are gross. They're like about 3-4 inches long and about as thick as your thumb. And
ugh.
Green.
Colored exactly like the plant. They were very hard to detect, and it seemed like they showed up overnight.
Did you get to see any of the parasites on its back, the like little white cocoons?
I did not. I
Darn.
Got rid of them as soon as I found them.
Good.
But, I did a little work on the internet, and I found because I was wondering how they got on the plants, being that they're hanging 10 feet off the ground from the underside of my deck, and it turns out that they are the larvae of the Carolina sphinx moth, and I found the leech that had all the eggs.
Oh, good, good. So you got rid of that.
I got rid of that, and I haven't seen any. They all showed up in about a week, and I had, I think, 16 on 3 plants, and I got rid of them. But the, I don't know if this is a wives' tale or what, but I've been told that if the plants were in the ground and you planted marigolds around them, that the smell of the marigolds keeps the worms away.
No.
Okay.
Do marigolds help with anything? Because I plant
they're
marigolds.
Pretty. They're pretty. Okay. They do attract beneficial insects, and they could. That particular one doesn't attract the wasp that parasitizes the tobacco hornworm and the other sphinx moths that like to eat our tomatoes in their larval stage. But if you plant dill and parsley, and those plants that have the umbel flowers, they attract those little parasitic wasps that then lay their eggs inside the tomato hornworm. This is really cool. And then,
oh, really?
Yes, it is. And the little larvae, well, the eggs are on top of the tomato hornworm, and then the larvae hatch and go inside and start eating the hornworm from the inside out. And you just watch them just kind of like, it's really cool. Anyway, so I tend to pick them off myself, but if any of them are parasitized, I let them stay on because they stop eating once the eggs are laid on them. And then little tiny parasitic wasps come out to get rid of the other ones in other people's gardens.
Oh, very good. On a totally unrelated note, mm-hmm. I, on a lark, planted a watermelon plant.
Mm-hmm.
I've got two nice watermelons, and I have absolutely no idea when to pick them.
That's a question I just looked up and didn't get a very satisfactory answer. But essentially, when you thump it, it should sound kind of hollow, and it should, when you lift it up, it should easily kind of like tug off of the vine. Except I think I have a ripe one and it's not tugging, so I'm not sure. But if anyone else out there has a perfect way of knowing when they're ripe, other than thumping them lightly and hearing that hollow sound, and I've also heard with the petiole yellowing, but then it might be a little too late. So good luck on that one.
Thank you, Mark, for that call. And that reminds me that, you know, harvest season, is coming up. So, Deborah, you'll have to come back and help us harvest everything. Lawrence in Bexley, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking the call.
You're welcome. I've got
some suggestions on growing tomatoes from seed.
Mm-hmm.
I grow almost all those plants in my garden from seeds that I save myself. And what I do is I take the best tomatoes. I like to grow Brandywine, all different types of cherry tomatoes, plum tomatoes, and try to do a really big variety of tomatoes, because sometimes some will do better in one year and some will do better in another year.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I let the tomatoes get very, very ripe, the best tomatoes, and then just cut them out and spread them out on paper towels, put them in a dry place in the kitchen, off on top of the refrigerator, on top of a pan of some kind, because you don't want it to get wet and then rust the
right.
top of the refrigerator, and just let it completely dry out, put them in old envelopes or plastic bags and save them for the next year. They do great.
All right.
That sounds wonderful.
Thank you, Lawrence.
You know, everyone has a tomato story, just like you said. Everyone has somehow had a story. Whether they like tomatoes or not, they have a tomato story. Maybe we should do a book of tomato stories.
I think so. You're right. If it's the number one thing in the garden, 9 out of 10 gardens in America have tomatoes. And Lawrence, by the way, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. If 9 out of 10 gardens in the United States have tomatoes mm-hmm. in them, really, there must be tomato stories out there. I want to ask you one quick question before mm-hmm. we let you go. Last year, you gave me a little bunch of tomatoes that kind of grew in like a grape type
yeah.
thing. What
mm-hmm.
were those called? And
were those
the
black cherries, or were they
It was like a bunch, like a cluster. Like
That was the traveler's tomato.
The traveler's tomato. Yeah, kind of like a pomegranate sort of thing almost.
Yeah, we didn't grow any of those this year, the traveler's, I'm sorry. we have 16 cultivars in our garden this year, and we just didn't have room for it. But next year I'm going to try a couple different ones. The Riesen tomatoes, there are several different traveler's tomatoes that you can pull apart. And eat.
They're very cool. So that was a lot of fun. She goes, you can take this home with you. And I'm like, by the time I was done with my tour, they were gone. So they're very easy to eat. Deborah Kanapke, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Deborah Kanapke. She is Central Ohio's garden sage, garden designer, consultant, author, and co-author of many gardening books. And she teaches horticulture at Columbus State Community College. And she'll be back with us in a few weeks, I hope, to talk about harvest season coming up. We're going to talk with an investigative journalist, Barry Estabrook, author of a new book called Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit wosu.org/email to sign up.
This is 89.7 NPR News, How to Live a Long Life. We'll talk about some surprising discoveries during Hour 2 of All Sides. That begins in 20 minutes at 11, right here on 89.7.
Support for 89.7 comes from United Way of Central Ohio. United Way brings partners together with community support to create lasting change in people's lives through programs in education, income, health, and home. More at liveunitedcentralohio.org.
Listen to 89.7 NPR News no matter where you are by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org, and with a simple click of the mouse, you can listen to your favorite radio station online. Listen to local and national news online anytime at WOSU.org. 76 degrees with partly sunny skies will reach a high of 87 today. There is a chance of showers and thunderstorms, especially tonight, a low of 66. Partly sunny for Friday and a high of 87 degrees. Partly cloudy Friday night, a low of 65. Some sunshine for Saturday and a high of 84. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I don't like tomatoes and I don't think they like me. I wouldn't say I hate them and they're not my enemy. We do our best to coexist by staying far apart. I don't like tomatoes, they always make me fart. I like tomatoes, and that's okay with me. But please don't put one on my plate or splat one on my knee. Spaghetti sauce, tomato soup, I love with all my heart. But I don't like tomatoes, they always make me fart. Too unhappy.
The fact is, few among us don't love tomatoes. They are second only to lettuce in their popularity as vegetables. And yes, we know that they really are a fruit. And Americans spend about $5 billion a year on that fruit. Joining us now to take a look at the tomato industry is journalist Barry Estabrook. He is 2009 article for Gourmet Magazine, Politics of the Plate, The Price of a Tomato, won a James Beard Award in 2010. This year, his blog, politicsoftheplate.com, won a James Beard Award as well. Welcome to the show, Barry.
Thanks for having me.
Your book isn't just about the plant, the tomato, the inferior product that is mass-produced largely in Florida now, or at least a third of them come from Florida, the ones in our grocery stores, but it's also about the industry and its treatment of its workers, especially the people who pick the tomatoes. Tell us about that.
Well, it's the people who pick our tomatoes, the tomatoes we get in grocery stores and in restaurants, are probably the most abused sector of the North American labor force. I was startled when researching the book to find out that slavery, outright slavery, is not uncommon in Florida. There have been seven major cases brought to justice in the past 15 years, freeing 1,200 people. And we're not talking about, you know, near slavery or slavery-like. We're talking about people being bought and sold like animals. We're talking about people being shackled in chains at night. We're talking about people being severely beaten if they don't work hard enough, shot in some cases if they try to escape, and, of course, not getting paid. And this is, it sounds a lot like 1850, but this was, in fact, happening now in Florida.
How can it, what's the deal in Florida? Is this something they're cracking down on, or what's the problem?
Well, they're trying to crack down on it, and they're making some headway. But the problem is that in Florida, the tomato industry is controlled by about a dozen very, very large corporations. They farm thousands of acres. And what they do is they contract the actual field work out to labor contractors, they're called. So they put themselves at once removed from the actual work that's done in their fields. And, you know, some of these labor contractors are unscrupulous, and that's how the situation develops.
Does it have anything to do with the nationality or the national origin of the pickers?
No, that's the interesting part. The 1,200 people that have been released from slavery represent, you know, everything from people who were born here in the United States to people who are here on guest worker visas to people who are here illegally. But the one thing that it has in common, and this is to me one of the big tragedies, is all of these people are desperate and down and out on their luck. And, you know, typically there'll be a group of them sitting outside a mission or something, and a guy will pull up in a van and say, any of you guys want to work? And it's the ones who are, you know, who they're down on their luck, and they're the one who raises his hands and says, yeah, you know, I'm willing to work to get out of this situation, and gets on the van is the person that ends up enslaved.
My guest is journalist Barry Estabrook. We're talking about his new book. It's called Tomatoland, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. If you have a question or comment for Barry, give us a call right now, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. You can tweet us at Ann Fisher WOSU. Many ways to talk. Tell about a third of the tomatoes in this country come from Florida, but you point out that Florida is not necessarily an ideal environment.
Well, this is one of the things that really struck me in doing my research. You know, we all picture the Sunshine State, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that, of course, Florida is also very, very humid. You just have to go down there this time of year. But even in the winter, it's a very humid, low-lying place. And as it turns out, tomatoes, their wild ancestors, are native to some of the driest areas in the world, the western coast of South America. And tomatoes hate humidity. And everything that would destroy a tomato vine, all the blights and funguses and rusts and mildews that will destroy a tomato plant thrive in humidity. So that's one thing to have going against them. The other thing is the tomatoes in Florida are growing in sand. I'm not talking about sandy loam or sand-like soil. It's sand. It's no different than the stuff that you find on Daytona Beach, and it's about as nutritious. So they have to be fed everything. All the fertilizer they need has to be injected into the sand, artificially, before the plants go in. So tremendous hurdles to successfully growing a tomato crop.
So why do they grow them there? Why not Texas?
It just so happens. It's all about commerce and nothing to do with horticulture. It's because during the time of year when Columbus, Ohio is buried in snow and there's nothing growing in Chicago and St. Louis and New York City and Boston and Philadelphia, it's warm enough to grow a crop of tomatoes in Florida, put them on a truck, and get them to market in a day and a half. That's the only reason they're growing there.
Now, the type of tomato that is grown now is not what Mr. Livingston, the founder of the first commercial tomato, the Paragon, had in mind, I don't think, when he started that business.
I'm afraid Mr. Livingston would be rolling over at his grave if you gave him a modern supermarket tomato. For the past 50 years or more, plant breeders, commercial plant breeders, not garden seed plant breeders, but people who breed for the commercial tomato industry, have bred crops for one reason and one reason only, and that's to produce huge quantities of tomato. An acre of commercial tomatoes today produces three times as much fruit as it did in the 1970s. And with all the focus on yield, flavor's simply gotten lost. A farmer told me, a big farmer, he said, and he was telling the truth, sadly, he said, "Barry, I don't get paid a cent for flavor. I get paid by the pound. And flavor's hard to breed for. So if the plant breeders are getting paid for tomatoes that give a lot of yield, they don't bother with flavor. And that's simply what happened."
It's not only what they can get the largest yield from. There's a board in Florida, going back to Florida for a moment, that dictates what a tomato should look like, but it doesn't dictate what it should taste like, nor what it should be composed of in terms of nutrients.
No, it's a group called the Florida Tomato Committee, and they really dictate almost everything to do with what tomatoes that are exported from Florida during the winter months look like. The size, the shape, the smoothness, the depth of what they call the stem scar, that's the sort of, you know, the thing on top where the tomato had attached to the vine.
Right.
Whether the depth, those little cracks that radiate out from that can be everything, the size of the boxes, everything except flavor.
Why?
Again, it's all appearance.
Why do they do that? Why do growers let them do that?
Well, the growers are, are it's they're complicit. You know, they're growing a commodity. They're growing a tomato that they want to be able to ship to Safeway today or Kroger's and Subway tomorrow. And the customers demand uniformity. So it's, everyone wins in this deal except the consumer.
The nutritional values pretty much almost non-existent, but there is, I think you said, 6 or 7 or 8 times the amount of sodium?
Oh, this is amazing. A modern tomato, modern supermarket tomato, and this is the United States Department of Agriculture's own statistics, per 100 grams contains like a third less vitamin C, a third less calcium, niacin. You can go down the list of nutrients, and it's everything is less. And it contains 14 times as much sodium
as its
counterpart in the 1960s.
Now, these tomatoes, these are the ones that we buy in the grocery store. They couldn't possibly provide the kind of flavor we get from tomato sauces that are processed and we get in the grocery store.
No, they couldn't. They could be much, much better. And in fact, there are a couple of teams working at the University of Florida to develop a tomato that is yields a lot, is tough enough to stand up to the demands of industrial agriculture, and deliver some taste. And they're making progress. In fact, probably within the decade, you'll be able to get a winter supermarket tomato that at least tastes like something. It's not going to taste like a beautiful summer tomato, but it will be much better than today's.
There are other tomato industries out there. Ohio harvested more than 1 million pounds of tomatoes in 2008. I know the state's ranked 5th for fresh tomato production and 3rd for processing tomatoes, but a lot of Ohio tomatoes don't go to the supermarkets. Is that right, or do they go into processing mostly?
Well, the thing is, the two big states, there's about 20 states in all that do commercial tomatoes at some level,
mm-hmm.
But Florida and California dominate. And in terms of canning tomatoes, that industry is really, it's in the process of shifting almost, you know, entirely to California. So, you know, this time of year, you're lucky in Ohio because you can probably go to a supermarket and find locally Ohio-produced tomatoes for
right.
sale. And they would have none of the problems involved with the labor issues or the flavor issues of a winter tomato.
There's a lot more emphasis on not only growing your own, but buying locally. And in Columbus, that's a really big deal in Central Ohio now. Has that changed anything about the industry necessarily?
Well, I think it has because I happen to live in Vermont in a small town, and I walked into my local supermarket last winter and just did a little survey, and there were 11 different types of tomatoes for sale in this little supermarket. You know, everything from cherry tomatoes and grape tomatoes and plum tomatoes to tomatoes on the vine to organic tomatoes. They came from Canada, Mexico, and Florida. 15 years ago, there would have been one tomato there. It would have probably been, you know, three of them lined up in a little cardboard container with some cellophane. So it's changing. It's changing because people are waking up to the fact that these tomatoes don't deliver on the taste front. Consumers, time and time again, rate tomatoes at the lowest end of their satisfaction on produce. And I think the farmers market movement is introducing people to tomatoes, real tomatoes that, you know, some people. Some young people don't know the taste of a real tomato till they eat a farmer's market tomato. It's astounded me.
My guest is Barry Estabrook. He's the author of a new book. It's called Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. If you have a question or comment for Barry, give us a call right now. We have about 2.5-3 minutes left, 614-292-8513. Where else if Florida, you know, is the source of about a third of the tomatoes, where do the other two-thirds come from?
Well, California, during
summer
months, the warm months, produces a lot of tomatoes. And then increasingly, Florida tomatoes are getting competition from Mexico. Every year, Mexico gets more and more of the market share. And also hydroponic tomatoes that are growing, a lot of them are growing in Canada, in places like Ohio as well, Arizona, the hydroponic greenhouse tomatoes. So that's the way it stacks up. Hydroponics and Mexico are growing. Florida is struggling.
When I see the hydroponics, they look better and they cut better. They look better when I cut into them, but the taste still is sort of in kind of middling.
Well, you know, hydroponic tomatoes are growing in sterile medium, so they have to be fed everything artificially. And in fact, to get a lot of taste, you have to feed them with a lot of very expensive fertilizer. So the tendency is to not do that. So that's why hydroponic tomatoes tend to be very bland. And because they grow inside, they also tend to be very beautiful.
Yeah, they're much prettier, that's for sure. What do you grow in your own backyard? What do you recommend?
What I recommend is you go to a farmer's market or talk to a friend and find out what grows well in your area. My main crop is a heirloom variety called Brandywine.
Mm-hmm.
They're very popular in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast.
Here as well.
In Florida, they're awful tasting. It's interesting.
Really?
Among gardeners. So it's not consistent. But I grow about 10 or 12 varieties. I grow Muscovitch, which is an early tomato, to get some early things. They're smaller tomatoes. I also grow some Paragons, which was the tomato that Livingston, his first great tomato. I grow that mostly just sort of as homage. And you know, they're a decent tomato. You can still buy them, and they're perfectly good tomato. Lots and lots of heirloom cherry tomatoes. I love those.
Mm-hmm.
I love just to make a little salad of five or six varieties of those, just the color and the different flavors. So, you know, Brandywines is the main tomato, and then I play around each year.
Okay. Well, Barry Estabrook, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Barry Estabrook wrote Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. We've been talking about tomatoes today, inspired by the Reynoldsburg Tomato Festival this weekend. If you want to learn more about that, you can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll have a link there for you. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.